White Rocket Entertainment. White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 390.
It's the Avengers Assemble podcast from the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net. Now, here's your host, Van Allen Plexico.
Hello, and welcome to the Avengers Assemble podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment, in association with all of our great supporters. You know who you are, via Patreon.com. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I'm joined again this episode by our great friend and longtime Avengers fan. Goes all the way back with me to the Jarvis Heads, the Avengers Assemble website and all that. David Wright, welcome aboard, David.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here. Finally back for Avengers Assemble.
Yeah, it's been a little while, hadn't it? We've done some other things, but you had an idea, you had a suggestion, and I'm going to let you tell the folks out there what we're doing today and why this seemed like a great idea.
Well, I had this idea a little over a year ago now, but what prompted this was the Black Panther movie that came out a year ago, February of 2018, and I just decided it'd be a good opportunity to dig into the old Roy Thomas run that included the Black Panther's introduction to the Avengers. So, and me being just selfishly being a Black Knight fan, decided to, I suggested to you that we cover this run of issues from issue 47 through 62. Mm-hmm. And that lets me get the Black Knight in there, but it also covers the Black Panther's introduction to the team and extends all the way to like his basically a solo story for him that's featured in issue 62. So it's a good sampling. It's just a little over a year's worth of issues. And it's right in the meat of what Roy Thomas was doing for the series. And there's a lot of really, really good stuff and important things that happen in this really short span of issues. And I thought it would be really cool to jump into it. Now, it took us a year for us to get coordinated enough and I guess for us both to get the research done to actually get around to doing this. I've had a few excuses, including a career change and a big move to a different state. So I'm happy to dig into it today.
Yeah, and it's an interesting run of issues. It just so happens, by happenstance and coincidence probably, to be a run of issues that I bought originally back in the late 70s in Marvel Triple Action reprints. So when I was reading these issues, I was very familiar with them and very familiar with the covers, even though they kind of redid the covers and kind of didn't. They slightly altered the covers to put Marvel Triple Action. And that was always, by the way, I thought a very strange name for an Avengers reprint. I assumed that Marvel Triple Action started out with like a trio of short stories every month. And then eventually they said, you know, we would sell more issues by just reprinting old Avengers stories than by having three separate solo stories or something like that. Maybe that's completely wrong, but that's the impression that I get. Kind of like the way Tales to Astonish and Tales of Suspense really were supposed to be, you know, anthology books about horror and monsters and stuff, and they mm-hmm. and sci-fi, and they quickly became, you know, Captain America and Iron Man and Hulk and all that. So anyway, yeah, these were Marvel Triple Action issues, and I read them back then. It was neat to come back and read them again in one run. Mm-hmm. And the thing that really stands out to me, we're gonna look at these over kind of an overview of this run and all the amazing things that were coming along during this period, and then we're gonna go dig down a little bit deeper. But the thing that really stands out to me during this run is it's only about, let's see, 47, 57, 59. It's not even a year and a half, right? It's just like a little over a year's worth of issues, and yet
right.
in those few issues, they introduce so many things that are like
that are big deals.
Oh, they're critical.
They're important to the...
Yes.
I call it foundation building for the series. A lot of what we know about the Avengers and about the characters, we see it happen right here in this little stretch of issues.
Yeah, and the Marvel Universe overall, because you got stuff that happens involving Thor and the Olympians. You got stuff involving Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch and Magneto and the Toad. You got stuff involving... the Black Panther and Wakanda. I mean, they really, not to mention stuff that's really very Avengers-centric, like the Grim Reaper, you know, and the Black Knight, right. And changes with Goliath and Pym and Yellowjacket. I mean, and the
Masters
Wasp,
of Evil. The Crimson Cowl and all this stuff.
I mean, I would say that this is to the Avengers what some of Stan and Jack's early Fantastic Four issues are in terms of just bucketfuls of foundational stuff just coming out one, you know, hand over fist.
Yes, absolutely. That's a great way of putting it. It was almost like every issue had some crucial brick in the foundation being laid down that was just going to provide stories for decades, really.
Yeah. And it wasn't long after this that they bring in like adamantium. I mean, Ultron. You get Ultron in this run. I mean, you get
Ultron, and I'll go ahead and spoil a little bit. I've read we're stopping at 62 today, but if you go only to issue 70, only 8 more issues after this, you get adamantium Ultron. You get the first Marvel appearance of adamantium. You get the first version of Ultron with adamantium. And you also get the first appearance of Archon and his whole world. And so all that happens between 47 and 70. It's even more concepts that are just coming out. And it's not too long after that that we get the Kree-Skrull War. So Roy Thomas was just knocking it out of the park during this time with the Avengers.
And I didn't even mention the Vision's first appearance. How could I miss that? I mean, that's super important. So
yeah. Between Vision and Yellowjacket, I mean, and Black Knight, Black Panther,
Wonder Man comes back. I mean, good heavens!
So it's crazy. I'm looking forward to digging into this. It's a lot of really important stuff, and almost all of it is drawn by John Buscema and.
Wow.
And his work is just amazing. So
It is.
Anybody who says they're an Avengers fan, these are issues that they need to read.
Now, I have to say, obviously, John Buscema is one of the absolute top Marvel artists of all time. There's just no doubt about it, especially on something like Thor, Conan the Barbarian, and the Avengers. But maybe it's the inking or what, but something about his work in these pages is different enough that I honestly wouldn't have known it was him in some of these issues.
Well, I can tell you this. I see a change, and I think we can credit it all to the inker George Klein. First of all, as a child of the 80s, I knew John Buscema as he is inked by Tom Palmer, which is a very different look, and I love it. We don't get that here, and I think what we get is more of Buscema shining through without Palmer's heavy hand. Mm. But John Buscema started work on the Avengers with issue 41. So you have to dial back a little bit past our scope today to see his first work on the series. And for the first stretch there, including into like 47 and 48, he looks like a very different artist. And I think most of those issues, if I recall correctly, are inked by George Tuska. And even all the way up, I remember issue 50, where we'll get into it, still doesn't, I mean, it looks good, but it doesn't look like the John Buscema that we know and love. And once George Klein comes onto the series, all that changes. And we get, it suddenly, the book looks very, very modern.
Yeah. I thought that must be the case. So, so we've established why this run is important. I want to talk a little bit more. We talk about the artist. This is, as much as John Buscema had to do with this, this is really the Roy Thomas show, right? I mean, Roy Thomas, for those that don't know, Roy Thomas, Stan hired him after a very brief stint at DC just to be a staff writer. It was funny. Roy called Stan up and made an appointment to see him, and they spoke very briefly. Stan gave him a writing test. Imagine Stan Lee giving Roy Thomas a writing test to see if he could write these characters. And then Stan asked him, you know, what would it cost to hire him away from DC? And Roy said, like, the $300 a month or whatever or a week that I'm making right now from DC, because he wanted to write these characters. And, you know, Roy has said in other places that he thinks that what Stan saw in him, beyond just his, you know, whatever writing ability and editing ability he eventually manifested, what Stan saw in him, and I know you'll get this, Dave, and I'm sure most of our listeners will, Stan had to work with corporate type people all the time who just looked at these characters in sense of what kind of money can they make for us, mm-hmm. right? And even some of the artists and writers that were around Marvel at the time were just freelance type people that they were just looking to make a buck. Mm-hmm. And Roy truly, you know, in other words, Roy walks in there and geeks out. Roy walks in there and knows the characters almost as well as Stan does. And Stan right. is like, this guy gets it. He's not doing it for the money, although he wants to be paid, but he's not doing it primarily for the money. He's doing it because he loves what we're doing here. And so I think that that plus his abilities caused Roy to get promoted up very rapidly and eventually within a couple of years pretty much, you know, becomes the editor-in-chief when Stan leaves to go to Los Angeles.
Well, you're absolutely right. So he's from Missouri. I think he was a high school English teacher. So he's a lit major, and you see a lot of Shakespearean and other classical references in his work.
Sure.
But he was someone who grew up with the Golden Age characters and loved the Golden Age and everything. But and then was also foundational in the budding fan movement, I guess, or at the dawn of the Silver Age. But yeah, what you're saying is true. What's a significant thing about Roy Thomas and the hiring of Roy Thomas is the fact that he represents the first fan to be hired as a professional. So before him, everybody there, these were these old magazine types and these old, you know, cartoonists just looking to make a buck. And you're right, they're kind of removed from it. And he's the first one to come at it with the passion of a fan
who can't believe
he has the honor to work with these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's the first professional fan that we get really in comics, and certainly in I can say that with confidence in regards to Marvel. I'm assuming it holds true across DC also.
Yeah, and I don't think he was at DC long enough to really make an impact there, but he certainly had an impact here. Now, as a writer, I have to say, and I'm trying to bear in mind that this is very early on, and really you have to compare, you know, as much as you can compare what Roy was doing in this era to what came later with the writers that we all revere from, you know, Conway and Englehart to Shooter and Michelinie and whoever else, Stern and whoever else, and then Busick. But I mean, you also got to realize that the only person that he had to go by coming in was Stan.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you compare this only backwards, like you say, how does this stack up to Stan? I think that his writing stacks up very favorably to Stan. Now, does it, you know, is it in the same style? Does it compare to stuff that came along a decade later? To me, in terms of the actual writing, no. I don't love his page-to-page, panel-to-panel writing. But in terms of the ideas, the characters, the plots, the plot devices that we were just talking about, right? It's amazing. I mean, it's second only to Stan and Jack, honestly, in my opinion.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think what we see here, when you start with this, just sticking to the Avengers here, you read the Stan Lee issues, mm-hmm. read through those, then Roy comes on, you start reading through those, and really it does hold true for his body of work, especially in the 60s, is what I see is there's a step forward, a progression in terms of plotting, from the Stan Lee style to what would come later. It's kind of a bridge going into the Bronze Age. But you're still, when it comes to actual scripting of dialogue and everything, you're still very much stuck in the bombastic Stan Lee style. And so it's, to me, it kind of represents a transition period for Marvel between Stan Lee and what would come in the 70s.
And to give go ahead.
I was just going to say, and you pair that with John Buscema's art in this run of issues, yeah. And it's suddenly these books, even though it's still very much of its time, they suddenly look very, very modern and read very much like a modern book compared to what came really not that much earlier.
Exactly.
With the Stan Lee and Don Heck Avengers. Suddenly you have Roy Thomas and John Buscema, which, by the way, we know what they would go on to do as a team in the 70s, being the ultimate Conan creative team. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a big step forward in terms of the, kind of just the progression of what Marvel was doing. But yes, the dialoguing and the scripting and everything, you can tell he grew up, you can tell who his influences were.
The two examples that I would – not examples, but the two illustrations I would give, Roy – when he writes dialogue, or he went back then when he wrote dialogue, and I don't think he does this as much, like you say, on Conan or even on Thor, but when he would write dialogue, he really gives this, and I guess he gets this from Stan, but he really comes across like he's writing for radio. It really jumped out at me reading these issues how much they read like radio drama scripts as opposed to comic book scripts. It's almost like he's not aware that this will be an illustrated story, and so he has to tell you in the words what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you and I think have spoken together and to others many times in recent years that in comics in the last 20 years or so, it's gone so far in the other direction that it's gone too far in the other direction. They don't tell you anything, and the writers rely so heavily on the artist to get the point across that if the artist is not quite up to the task, the reader's lost, right?
Right.
If the artist can't explain to you in visuals what's going on, you don't have any writing to tell you. But Roy, on the other hand, writes like a radio script. Like, you know, if you ever listen to an old radio drama or you read a script from a radio drama, what they'll do is they'll say, like, you know, like a Superman show. It'll be like Superman's like, you know, Lois will be like, "Superman, I see you standing there, you know, next to the villain." And Superman will say, "Yes, Lois, I see you that you see me, and I am now going to punch the villain. Oh, Superman has punched me in the face," you know, because you have to get that across to the listener. They have no other cues but what they're being told. And I want to go back in time to the mid-60s and grab Roy and say, "We'll see it in the pictures. You don't have to keep explaining it, you know?"
Right.
But
right.
Roy has the characters do that. He'll have, you know, like Magneto say, "Oh, Quicksilver, you dolt, why have you punched me in the face like that?" And you just want to. And the other thing that kind of feeds into my other one, which is that Roy really did write the bombast. You know, I love how every villain, no matter how maniacal or not, is so over the top. They call everybody dolt and cur and lackey. I mean, Magneto just browbeats the poor Toad to death. But, I mean, they all do. And, I mean, even like the villains that would be like a, you know, like a Bowery bum fighting the Thing would still have some grand proclamation. Instead of just being like, "Oh, I'm going to get you." Instead, they're like, you know, "Avast thee, Thing, I shall now drop my malevolent will upon you," you know. And the heroes have their own tick, which is that they all, well, one thing that drives me crazy, and I guess he got this from Stan, they all have nicknames for each other, which drives me insane, right?
Oh, yeah.
Especially Hawkeye. I understand Hawkeye's popular, but I remember now why I've never really liked Hawkeye. Hawkeye annoys the crap out of me. I just want to duct tape Hawkeye's mouth shut in most of these issues. It's everything is, "Hey, Jungle Man."
Yeah.
"Hey,
yeah,
some
of Roy's nicknames for the Black Panther, they're a little cringy.
They are, but he does it for everybody. You know, he just has a nickname. But everybody has a nickname for everybody. Hawkeye is just the worst at it. And every character brags incessantly, "Well, you didn't stop the villain, but when I wreak my powers upon him, he will be laid low." Boom, smack, pow, you know. "Oh, well, Hawkeye, your arrows didn't work, but wait until he feels the unfettered might of my diamond hard power." You know, everybody has to brag incessantly about what they can do. And again, it just gets a little heavy. It gets a little thick at times. But the overall stories, though, are great. I wish that he could have dialed it back just a couple of notches is all.
Yeah, I agree with you. And bragging is probably a way of feeling like he has to explain everybody's power set in every issue.
Yeah.
And certainly when you read them in a block, it gets a little repetitive.
It does. I just honestly, I don't know how people like Hawkeye. I just don't. I mean, maybe nowadays he's not so bad, but if you were older than me and grew up reading these issues originally, I would be like, this guy's got to go. He is the biggest pain in the butt. I can't take him. I can't take him anymore. So,
well, I can't say much. I'm a Hawkeye fan, so I can't.
Oh,
I can't follow you there.
I like him in the modern era, but man, I'm just saying, if you knew him back here only back then, I just don't see how anybody could have stood him. He's insufferable. all right. So, anything else before we dig into the issues a little bit and what's going on?
I don't think so. I think we're ready.
All right. Well, so let's see. We're going to start out with 47 and really 47, 48, 49. Just to point out that I get the sense that Roy did not want to write Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch, and so he looked for an opportunity to get rid of them. Before we talk about anything else, that's one of the main subplots and major plots that runs through these early issues here, is him basically getting rid of Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch. What do you take from that?
Well, I don't think it's anything personal against those two characters. I think he was ready for a change in the roster. And what I really like about this is they did it very organically. It wasn't as ham-fisted as a single issue of, hey, we're all quitting, and hey, the old order changeth. Hmm. But what you see, what we kind of pick up right in the middle of it with issue 47, is he's in the process of shedding members, and he's going to strip the team down to just three people, and then he's going to build it back up over the course of these issues that we're looking at today. So 47, 48, and 49 is a three-part story. It happens to introduce Dane Whitman and the Black Knight, but it's really a Quicksilver, Scarlet Witch, and Magneto story.
Mm-hmm.
And what we got just before these issues is Captain America quit. And Roy didn't get rid of Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch right away. He'd been writing the book for a while, and they'd been on the book for a while. But what you see here is he gets rid of Captain America, which was, I think, must have been just before issue 47.
Mm-hmm.
And in this three-part story, he gets rid of, we end up without Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch by the end of it. They're off the team. And a subplot that runs through these three issues and is then resolved in issue 50 is Hercules is off on his own exploring what's happened in Olympus, because it's all empty and devastated. And at the end of 50, he decides to stay away from the team. And so you get down to the point where all you have left, the Avengers, are nothing but Hank, Jan, and Hawkeye. And that's the whole team.
Mm-hmm.
And then they start building it back up. We start adding members. That's when you start getting Black Panther and Vision, and we go on from there. And so by the end of this run of issues, the team looks very, very different. But it was a very organic roster change. Mm-hmm. You kind of had members flowing out and members flowing in. And so for me, it really worked. But definitely 47, 48, and 49 were about getting rid of Wanda and Pietro. Now, what I don't know, and I should have researched this a little bit, is I'm assuming that this lines up with Roy Thomas writing the X-Men. And that's what happened. They moved over to the X-Men. So it's not like he hated them and didn't want to write them. I think he just wanted him in the X-Men.
Hmm.
Somebody's going to call me out on that. Maybe Stan was still writing the X-Men here in 1968, but I don't think so. So it's interesting. I don't know enough about – I'm an Avengers guy. I'm not an X-Men guy. It's because when we get into this story here with issue 47, Magneto and the Toad are exiled on some foreign planet.
Yeah.
And I don't know how they got there. Maybe there's an X-Men issue that shows that happening, and maybe they've been off the table, off stage for a long time. I don't know how long since their previous appearance, but Roy uses this issue and introduces a scientist named Dane Whitman, mm-hmm. who decides to communicate with other planets through magnetism. And I don't know how that works. And I didn't know that about Dane. That's not really something that stayed with him as a character. No. But he ends up accidentally bringing Magneto and Toad. So the world can thank Dane Whitman for rescuing Magneto and bringing him back to Earth. Who knows? Maybe he'd still be there if it wasn't for Dane.
And this was the crazy talking, malevolent Magneto that bears little resemblance to the Malcolm X style, you know, I'm just the leader of an oppressed people trying to get along here, Magneto, right. that we kind of see later. This is the cackling, give Dr. Doom a run for his money, and in fact did in a great supervillain team-up series in the mid-70s where the two of them fought and the Red Skull also was involved. So, yeah.
And now Buscema's version of Magneto doesn't look like the character that we think of when we think of Magneto. He looks like some crazy old man, like you say, maniacal. But I do love his version of the Toad. I thought he nailed the Toad there. So.
Oh yeah, and the poor put upon. In fact, and you'll recognize this when Bobby Polite and I were writing the early Sentinels books, a big part of the influence of Francisco working for the Warlord was the Toad's relationship to Magneto in these early issues of the Avengers.
Right. Definitely can see that.
The scraping and crawling, you know, lackey flunky that is constantly put upon, but yet occasionally can turn the tide, you know, turn things around on him. So tell us a little bit about the Black Knight then. What is it about him that makes you such a fan of his, and a little bit about his origin here and what's worth knowing?
Okay, well, I'm not a fan because of his origin.
Okay.
But I am just someone who loves our Arthurian legend and those types of stories, knights in shining armor. I write fiction in that genre, and I've always enjoyed reading medieval fantasy, and I've always the traditional King Arthur and Robin Hood and Ivanhoe legends and all that stuff. So I am just going to be predisposed to like a character like Black Knight. Now, in terms of a comic character, I appreciate that there's a tie all the way back to the Atlas era original Black Knight stories. And what you get, if you put the pieces together, if you read all of Dane Whitman's appearances and make a shopping list of what we've learned about him, we get a lot of stuff that he's really kind of fairly fleshed out in terms of he has his own headquarters. He's got his own animal sidekick. He's got his own unique equipment. He's got a cast of supporting characters. He's got multiple villains that have, that make good villains in terms of having a personal stake and rivalry with them. And there's a lot there. If more people felt there's enough there to support an ongoing series for him, if he just had enough fans that would actually buy his book like me.
Well, I've read some interesting comments from Roy about bringing him back. There were apparently two versions. I knew about the villainous version that was his uncle, right, I guess?
That's right.
And
yeah, so in the original, the Black Knight that we got, the villainous Black Knight, was Nathan Garrett. Turns out that's Dane's uncle. But he first appeared, I believe, in Tales of Suspense as an Iron Man villain. He would then later show up as a member of the original Masters of Evil in early Avengers, probably issue number 6, I think it is. I'm going by memory. Sometime there in the first year of the Avengers.
That's right.
Now I don't know enough about Nathan Garrett to know if he was explicitly connected to the Atlas era comics. So in the late 50s, Stan Lee and an artist named Joe Manili, they did a series of stories featuring Sir Percy, the Black Knight. Now, these stories were actually set in the time of Camelot, and this was prior to Fantastic Four number 1, so there was no real Marvel universe yet.
Yeah.
But what we get with Dane Whitman is a legacy that goes back and ties into those Stan Lee and Joe Manili stories.
Nice.
Now Nathan Garrett, of course, is a part of that legacy, but I don't know if that connection was made until Dane's introduction.
Okay.
Well, so what you got here was there prior to this issue, in an issue of Tales of Suspense, in an Iron Man story, there was a battle between Iron Man and the evil Black Knight, and he fell from his horse and basically got mortally wounded, and Dane, and then in this issue, Dane shows up at his bedside before he dies, and he basically like lets him know, hey, sorry about that. I've been a bad guy. I want you to, you know, carry on my legacy. And Dane decides he'll do so for good.
Yeah. And what Roy has said about it, it visually was interesting to me, was he said that he was all set to introduce his new version of the Black Knight, and it had to, the way the scripts were lining up, it had to be in issue 48. He couldn't push it back or anything. But it turned out that John Buscema was not going to be drawing, he thought. I don't know if he did or didn't, but I can't remember offhand. But he was not going to be drawing it. And, yeah. And Roy had said, if John Buscema were drawing it, I would have just said, you know, design the Black Knight.
Right.
But because he knew that it was, I think, going to be just Tuska alone doing that issue.
That's right.
He sat down, Roy sat down with John Verputin, and and they designed his look so that Tuska wouldn't do it, because he didn't trust Tuska to do it. And he says, in retrospect, they made him too busy looking, but they would have rather John have designed him, but the design he ended up with was the one that Verputin kind of came up with, and he just didn't want Tuska's version. And I thought that was kind of amusing, and I think it works pretty well. I like his look. It is busy. Oh, and the other thing he said if he had to do over again, he wouldn't name the horse Aragorn, because he did that as a Lord of the Rings, sort of a Tolkien reference. And he said, I don't even like Tolkien that much. He's more of a Robert E. Howard guy, obviously, you know.
Yeah.
So he's like, I named him Aragorn, not really thinking about Lord of the Rings ever being that popular. And so I kind of, in retrospect, wish I hadn't named the horse Aragorn. I think this horse shows up later in Iron Man when there's a villain that's like been welded into a mask that rides this horse later on, and I can't remember.
Well, you might be thinking of the Death Knight.
Yeah, Dread Knight or Death Knight or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, Dread Knight. Knight, it was a villain that was introduced later in Iron Man, and his whole deal was that he picked up the gear that Nathan Garrett, the evil Black Knight from the Masters of Evil, was using. So he basically copped all his gear and decided to be a bad guy.
That was one of my first issues of Iron Man, by the way. That was when I was really a little kid. I read that very early on. Yeah.
And if I were writing a Black Knight ongoing series, the Dread Knight would be in the Rogues Gallery.
Oh,
for sure.
Awesome. Yeah.
So about Black Knight's design. Look, I had the pleasure of meeting George Tuska in person. It was at a Heroes Con a long time ago, I think 2001. And, you know, he looked like a sweet old man. And he was hunched over his drawing board and looked like he had spent decades in that position and probably couldn't sit up straight. And I have absolutely nothing against the guy at all, but my goodness, he was not my favorite artist. And to have this issue, the Black Knight introduction issue, be the only one in this whole series that's not drawn by John Buscema really kind of rips at my gut. I'm just really disappointed in that. However, the design we got for the character is one I'm very grateful for. Now, they tweaked it after this first appearance. He's got weird stuff going on with the color scheme here, yellow gloves and boots and red trim and all this kind of stuff. They figure that out. By the time we see him again, I think in issue 61, they've got the color scheme sorted out, and he looks fantastic. Now, I was giving George Tuska a little too much credit. I knew enough of this story, but I didn't know the Verputin part. I was left with the impression that Tuska had actually designed the Black Knight's look, and I was going to give him all the credit for like, well, look, he might not be my favorite artist, but he designed my favorite character. But it sounds like he didn't have a hand in that. And, you know, and I understand, like I said, I have absolutely nothing personal against the guy. I'm sure he was an awesome guy and, he had a solid career, but, he's probably not the guy you want leading the charge on the Avengers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although he did handle his share of issues of the Avengers and Iron Man, I believe.
That's right. Well, I guess we get to 50, and it's pretty much Hercules against Typhon. Now, I have to say, I have a soft spot in my heart for this knucklehead Typhon. He is a big doofus, but you know, one of my very first Avengers issues was, I believe, 163. which was a fill-in issue where Iron Man and the Champions fought each other because Typhon made it all happen. And at the end, I think Iron Man takes out Typhon. And I'm like, well, who is this Typhon guy? He was kind of wimpy. And then you go back and read that really early Marvel triple action where he first, you know, appears and fights Hercules, I guess. And this must have been his second time fighting Hercules in this issue.
It's his first. This is their only showdown in Avengers. So if it happened somewhere else, I wouldn't know about it. But so I don't know when that would have been. This is 1968. Maybe it showed up in Thor before or something.
Maybe so. I know I've read another Typhon story where he like put his hammer thing in a pot of fire to do something. Or I don't know. Anyway, but
okay.
But yeah, this was cool. I mean, it's because it's neat. You don't get a lot of the Olympians. You get a lot of Asgard. You don't get a lot of the Olympians. So it's always nice to see Hercules back home doing stuff and having Ares running around in the background and Zeus and all that.
Yeah. So what you get? So first of all, let's just admire the cover. The cover to issue 50 is just amazing. I love the composition of it. I love the figure work that Buscema has done. You got Hawkeye swinging in with a rope tied around his leg, and that's all. And he's shooting his arrow while he's swinging in. It looks awesome.
Yeah.
But what I'd say about Hercules, now I like Hercules a lot too. The series, The Incredible Herc, did a lot to make me a Hercules fan. I describe him as he's like Thor, but more bro.
Yeah.
he's like a frat boy kind of version of a god here.
Yeah.
But he's had major runs with three different writers: Roy Thomas, Roger Stern, and Bob Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And each of them eventually turned the spotlight on Hercules for a story. So you got the War of Olympus with Stern. You've got the you got the whole thing with Harris where he's stripped of his immortality by Zeus, and that whole thing goes on. But here, this is the big Hercules story. Now, Roy Thomas comes back and focuses on Hercules. I think with issue 100, there's an Olympian focused story there. But I haven't read that recently, so I can't get into that too much. But here is the culmination to what he had been doing. Now, again, I'm jumping all over the place here, but we talked earlier about how the plotting that Roy Thomas is doing is a step more toward the modern era away from Stan Lee. And we see that with Hercules in terms of he's a one page subplot for a few issues prior to this, kind of percolating in the background. And then once that Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch story is over, then the Hercules stories comes up to the front and we deal with it here. And so that's kind of a, you know, that's a modern wrinkle there that Stan Lee wasn't really doing. And so you get, and so this is the big showdown. And I think Buscema really shines here. He still, let me double check the inker credit here because I could be wrong. Yeah, George Klein is not the inker here. In fact, I think Buscema's inking himself. So it still doesn't have that final look that we're going to get very soon. But he really shines. The work is awesome. And this is, he's got, as we'll see on the rest of these issues today, if you go back and look these up, there's a run of just really powerful, impactful splash pages that start off every issue. And to me, this is one of them. And it's a simple shot of a close-up of three people. You got Hank and Hawkeye yelling at each other with Jan in the middle trying to calm them down. But just the power of it. I mean, I just think the way he draws it, it's just really awesome. It really grabs your attention.
An interesting choice for 50th. It is funny that, yeah, Avengers 50 and Avengers 100 both involve Hercules and Olympus. That's kind of odd. I hadn't thought about that.
And I'm sorry, I'll say this about 50. Obviously, John Buscema was known as someone who wasn't really thrilled with the idea of superheroes. It was not his first choice of what to draw. He did a lot of it because it paid the bills, I guess.
Right.
But you see him shine on characters like Conan.
Mm-hmm.
And he shines on Conan, and he shines best on characters like Conan. And you kind of see a lot of that with the way he's drawing Hercules here in this whole battle. It's not very far away from what a Conan story might look like, at least coming from him in 1968. So
that's a good point.
I think,
yeah.
my guess is that he really enjoyed drawing this one more than some of the others.
Yeah, and that's very true. I mean, every artist has their things that they're better at and enjoy more. And that's very, very true about Buscema, because, I mean, I think his best work really is on Thor and Conan, and those are both much more fantasy-oriented and grounded in some ways, even though Thor is, you know, mystical and fantasy. You know, there's a lot of cosmic stuff to him, but even so, you know, it's guys with swords and guys with hammers, you know, running around with capes and sailing ships, even if they're in outer space, you know. So there's, yeah, he's better with that than with the inside of an office building and, you know, guys in suits and ties. And that's just how it is. and it just works better. So, well, I'm going to say we then go and get a great collector issue. And this one has a lot of parallels with some stuff that, in fact, it's funny. Think about this. When you and I were reading the Kurt Busiek run back in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, Kurt was intentionally echoing a lot of stuff from Englehart and Shooter and Michelinie. And if you look at the stuff from that era, it echoes a lot of stuff from Roy Thomas's era in turn.
Yes.
So you get things like the Grim Reaper, the Vision and Wonder Man, just like we would get later with Shooter. And you get stuff like this, where they're aboard the Collector spaceship, just like you get, you know, in 174, famously, with Hawkeye versus the Collector. And right. So we get that Avengers versus the Collector, I guess probably for the first time, story here in 51. And again, pretty good. They bring back Thor, bring back Iron Man, at least temporarily. And you're paving the way for the introduction of the new characters that are coming in 52.
Yes, and you do get the, and as a side note, you do get the costume change for Goliath. He finally moves away from the blue and yellow, but you're right, and I think what you're speaking to is like, yeah, Kurt was drawing on those late 70s influences, and oh, I see now those guys were drawing on the Roy Thomas influence of the 60s. Well, so what you get is what you see here is just the DNA of the Avengers is just being laid down issue after issue. Even if it's not your favorite style of dialogue, even if the pacing of the issues doesn't suit you for whatever reason, these are the building blocks. This is what makes the Avengers the Avengers.
Absolutely.
And to me, it's almost like it's like because of when I came into reading the series starting in the early 80s, and then everything prior to that was a discovery for me. And by the time you get to these issues, Oh, this is the first Collector. This is the first Vision. This is the first Yellow Jacket. It's like discovering like some Old Testament scripture, you know? It's like some artifact from an Indiana Jones movie. It's like, oh, this is where it happened. This is it. This is not a reference or a flashback or a footnote. This is the story.
And sometimes that's made very apparent, like with the Vision, where they say, look, here comes the Vision. Do-do-do. Other times, you're sitting there, if you're like me, you're sitting there going, is this the first time that this has happened? I think it's the first time, but I can't be sure. So, you know, sometimes Roy and John put a big flashing siren on this stuff and say, first appearance. But other times you just kind of have to figure out, like with the Grim Reaper or with or with some of the others, you know, the Yellow Jacket, you just kind of have to go, or Typhon, you kind of have to go, did this character, is this like the fifth time they faced this person? I'm not entirely sure. And I don't mean that in a bad way, because that's good. That means it's just an organic story where they're not having to stop and hit you over the head with like, this is the first time, true believer. You know, you don't want that, but it still left me kind of wondering a couple of times. I'm like, is this really the first? I had to think this was the first Grim Reaper story just because, good Lord, his costume looks terrible.
Yeah, and you're right. And now Grim Reaper, is it this issue? No.
52. Yeah, we're
okay.
As,
yeah,
as we so transition 52. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, I was the same way specifically with the Grim Reaper. I was like, okay, so is this actually his very first appearance? I had to go look it up, and it was. It is. This is it. This is the Grim Reaper. So and we get, this is the issue, right, where we find out Wonder Man's his brother. The Vision's built off Wonder Man. Grim Reaper's got a beef. So it's right here. It's happening here. This is not a reference to anything else. It's not a flashback. This is the story that ends up becoming the basis and the foundation for so many stories that were to come. I will say, though, as we're leaving issue 51, We get a nice bit of continuity at the very end of the issue where we check in with Captain America, who is in Wakanda with T'Challa. This actually jibes very, dovetails very nicely with Tales of Suspense at the time. Very, very early on in Black Panther's existence, he was in that first introductory Fantastic Four issue, and I believe that was it. And then he shows up again with Cap in Tales of Suspense, and then this is like only his third or fourth appearance ever. He's had no other stories. He's had the first Fantastic Four story, which was, I think, more than one issue, and then he had his little Tales of Suspense story with Captain America, and now he's joining the Avengers. And so we're still getting him as a very new and blank slate character to a large extent.
Yeah, and this wouldn't have been the story I would have expected that he first appeared in here with the Grim Reaper, because that opens up that whole can of worms with the Williams brothers, with the Vision's mental pattern, brain patterns. I mean, I've always used the metaphor that Avengers Mansion has a lot of wings to it, and this is the whole Simon Williams, Vision, Eric Williams, Scarlet Witch wing.
Yeah, but who built those wings of the mansion?
Yeah, exactly.
They're being built right here as we read these issues, and that's what, to me, is exciting about it. Yes, I agree with you about the dialogue and the narration and the bombasticity of it all. But what's happening in these stories is so important to the DNA of the whole series.
Absolutely.
And now what you're talking about, yeah, we're already getting a lot with Grim Reaper and Simon Williams and all that stuff. And we're getting Black Panther and multiple pages of him in action. I mean, that's just how much good critical stuff was getting jammed into such a short amount of time here. So he was just double stacking it.
And he's
go ahead.
Well, he's the Panther here too. Interestingly, they just call him Panther, and he's half of his mask is missing. They also got rid of his cape, but
yes, I was just about to mention that the little half mask where you almost like the Batman style mask where you're seeing his nose and jaw.
Yeah,
that did not last long at all. I think it's only in these first Avengers issues. I'd have to go double check the Captain America Tales of Suspense issue. I know he's got a full mask for his first appearance in Fantastic Four. This might have been a John Buscema thing, or maybe Roy Thomas requested it. Clearly, it doesn't look right to us because we've come to know him in a different way, and it doesn't last long at all. Within two or three issues, it's gone. But yeah, he's called the Panther, and he doesn't have the full mask, so They were still kind of figuring him out, but it speaks to how new this character is. I mean, this is still very much a brand new character that's coming onto the team here.
And the chemistry is so good because nobody really trusts him. He is a foreign person, obviously, to the Avengers and to the United States at this point. And he's a sneaky guy by nature, obviously. His whole thing is stealth and creeping around and all, which doesn't lend itself well to somebody, you know. It's not like Captain America walking in the door in a red, white, and blue uniform and shield, you know. I mean, the Black Panther sneaks in your skylight in a black suit, and you're supposed to be like, oh, hey, welcome aboard. No, you're like, what's this guy doing, you know. Just by his very nature, he kind of makes you go, wait a minute, who is this? And so when he just shows up, you know, he kind of gets accused of killing the Avengers. And by the way, this is another thing that's echoed later. This is when the Avengers are zapped into comas and they're thought to be dead, which is something that Shooter brings back in 161 and 162, because Ultron uses the same technology the Grim Reaper did with his encephalo beam to make people seem like they're dead. And by the way, when I read that, and I read it years ago, but when I read it again this time, I was thinking, well, now, how did the Avengers not think to check for that when it happened to them in 162? You know, 161, 162. They should have been like, wait, this happened before, you know?
You're absolutely right about that. But as far as, like, this being the timing of introducing Black Panther, this is again, speaks to that organic roster change that Roy was executing during this time. He got rid of the old guys, you know, Hercules, everybody else. And now he's bringing on the characters he wants to have on the team, and he clearly wants Black Panther. But my goodness, Grim Reaper's first costume design, what were they thinking?
Oh, gosh. I mean, in black and white, it looks fine. And it looks fine later when they take exactly the same costume and just color it kind of black or dark blue, you know. But
yeah, this is orange, green, purple, blue.
What in the world are they? Yeah, I mean, and on a bright yellow background, I mean, he just looks, it's a train wreck. It's pretty
well, now, what's funny is fast forward to the Kurt Busiek era, they did a Wonder Man story, and there's a flashback to this first appearance of the Grim Reaper, and they're showing him. It's pretty much this, I think George Perez pretty much drew him in the same pose that you see on the cover of issue 52. But Tom Smith was the colorist, and he did the whole thing monochromatically. Like he wasn't gonna show us how garish these colors were.
Kurt should have thrown in something like having Eric say something like, when I knocked those chemicals over in the lab just before I attacked the Avengers and it spilled all over my costume and changed the colors like that, it was a nightmare. But I had no time to change. I had to go into action, you know. But
let me say one more thing about 52, because it's Wonder Man. We don't get Wonder Man really. We get flashback scenes of him. This is Roy Thomas being the fan who's now the pro. For the first time, we're starting to see him reach back. I shouldn't say the first time. Like Nathan Garrett was a member of Masters of Evil in number 6. But here's Simon Williams, who was just a one-off guy in issue number 9, who showed up, was going to betray the Avengers. In the end, he didn't, died a hero, and that was it. And that was issue 9 in like 1964. And it's been
way back.
And no one's thought about him since. Here's Roy Thomas finding a way to bring him back. I mean, to tie in his new stuff with what's happened before to strengthen that continuity. Oh, and he was really the first writer who cared about doing stuff like that.
That's right. And it's so effective because, again, it weaves that superstructure through the whole series and through all these characters' lives and gives it much more depth.
Absolutely.
It's very effective. And by the way, I just realized looking at that cover, the Grim Reaper's cover of 52, I realized something I've wanted my whole life and never realized it, and that is that I need the Grim Reaper to fight Claw. Battle of the guys with something on their hand. That'd be a good fight. I love his little... I love the idea that if you did the Grim Reaper today, he would be a much more supernatural, and they've done it this way, right? A more supernatural, you have like a CB holding an actual scythe and all that. But this being the 60s, with gadgets and stuff, his scythe is like a thing, like Claw's little horn, but with a blade on it that'll spin around and do electrical blasts and stuff. It's just, there's no other era when they would have made the Grim Reaper work that way. And it's so cool in a cheesy way,
And I'm not sure he works. The only reason he works as a character is, well, two things. They redesigned the costume.
Yeah.
But also his connection to Simon, which means his connection to Vision, which is his connection to Ultron and Hank and everybody. And it's the weaving of the characters and that cast of characters that really makes everything work. And I would have to say it's probably the only reason Grim Reaper's had any kind of longevity.
Yes. If he wasn't Eric Williams, he would be utterly forgotten. Nobody would care.
Yep.
But that's exactly right. So I guess 53 and 54 maybe? And I guess
53 is the second half of a crossover.
The X-Men.
With the X-Men. And then 54 and 55 are one story.
Okay, so what do you... I didn't have a whole lot out of these I really want to get into, other than, man, I love the Whirlwind and Claw. I love them so much, and the Melter's the stupidest character of all time.
Okay, I don't have much to say about the X-Men appearance. I first read this issue when it was reprinted with issue number 350, I think, when Bob Harris was writing the Avengers, and he was the editor of the X-Men, and there was... 1993 was the 30th anniversary for both series, and they were doing a lot to celebrate both teams that year. And so one thing they did was find this, reprint this issue that has the X-Men and the Avengers together. And that's my first time reading that issue. And I've read it again this time, and I've never read the first half of the crossover. But clearly it's one that is written by Roy Thomas. So he was just kind of putting everything together. And I don't know if there's anything significant that comes out of this that needs to be discussed. In truth, I'm scanning through the pages now. But certainly, if you're a fan of the X-Men, or if you're a fan of continuity, as Roy Thomas certainly was, it's a nice little way to tie the two teams together. And then, we get into the Masters of Evil story. So 54 and 55, is another version of the Masters of Evil. I don't think we've seen the Masters of Evil since the early Stan Lee days. I think the very first was simply Zemo, Enchantress, and Executioner. That was it. That's what they called themselves.
Yeah.
And then they came back with a team of some mortal villains, which Radioactive Man, I think, was a part of that. And then that was it. They've been kind of off stage and forgotten. That was Heinrich Zemo's team, or maybe it was Zemo's team. Mm-hmm. Here, it's organized under a different leader, and we're going to find out who that is. So
yes,
we don't have to get too far into it. I don't guess. First thing I'll say is the cover to issue 54. Black Knight comes back. Thank you very much. He's still in his yellow cape, so that's not awesome. But but I love to have him there. Now, the cover reminds me of, you're going to have to help me out, the George Perez cover where you've got similar guys in chains in the foreground. Mm-hmm. I think it's the old, I think it might be around 169 or something like that.
It's probably in the 150s, I believe. It's before I started. I started with 158 is the first issue I actually bought. So I'm 162 is my first one I read, but 158 is the first one. So it was before that.
Yeah.
It was right before 158, that.
158, 159, that sounds about right. That's what it reminds me of. But what you get with this story, you're right. Now, listen, I know the Melter's stupid and the Whirlwind is stupid.
Hey, don't you knock on the Whirlwind.
Wait a minute.
I love Whirlwind and Claw. They're a classic. Melter is the one trick pony and his pony is stupid.
I mean, we love lame villains, right?
Absolutely.
I know you love D-list villains.
Oh, Stiltman is one of my favorite villains. Come on, dude that's 60 feet tall and robs helicopters. That's genius.
And the Porcupine and all those guys.
Oh, yeah.
But what's funny about the Whirlwind is he's actually Hank and Jan's chauffeur.
Yes, exactly.
Jan's chauffeur.
this is the supervillain of Downton Abbey.
And there's actually a scene that takes place in the garage, you know, with Jan's Rolls Royce. And of course, the chauffeur is going to be an evil supervillain.
That's great.
Some of these guys are lame, but we love lame villains.
Yeah.
And one thing the Avengers need, and this has been discussed before on this podcast, is it's hard to develop a good rogues gallery for a concept like the Avengers, where it's a team of people and the roster is usually changing. Mm-hmm. And we have a couple of really good heavies, but we don't have a long list.
Yeah.
And so to be able to bring back an evil team, mm-hmm, is a good idea. So Roy, I think, is trying to do that again. He's reconstituted the Masters of Evil with a new roster. Of course, this is the Crimson Cowl story.
Yeah. Well, so, before we get to him, I want a couple of things. One, you're right. I guess the only villain teams that really even come close to the Masters of Evil in Avengers history would be Zodiac to a certain degree and Lethal Legion. And there's a lot of bleed over between Lethal Legion and some versions of the Masters of Evil anyway, like the Whirlwind and whatever. So, you're right. They don't really have – they really have big one single villain like Ultron and Kang and Thanos much more than they do teams. Now, I also want to know what school you go to get a Masters of Evil because – and can you go ahead and just get a full PhD of evil? And surely Zemo has that, right? And the other thing I want to say about 54, I love the idea that the Black Knight had been a villain forever and suddenly it's a new guy as a good version of that character. And he's almost the Thunderbolts in reverse here. Where he's infiltrated.
He's the same guy, even though the costume's totally different.
He infiltrates the villains because they're stupid enough to think it's the same guy, and he must still be a villain. And I think that's really cool. That's a great idea.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not going to argue with that. I love the Black Knight. And you get a little bit of him in his castle, and he's on his horse, and he's looking cool, and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
So let's see, where do we go from there? I don't have great memories of, I have to even see, 55 and 56.
Well,
before
now
we get to the Vision.
Just real quick, Crimson Cowl.
Yeah. That's right.
It looks like Jarvis has betrayed the team. And he's you have to say in the end, he is definitely tempted to do that. His mom is sick and needs the money, but he gets. Is he brainwashed or something like that? He ends up, the big reveal at the end of 54, you take off the Crimson Cowl's hood and it's Jarvis. So it's like suddenly Jarvis is going to be the supervillain, mm-hmm, which was, you know, not a lot had been done with Jarvis up until then, except get tied up by Hawkeye, you know, something like that. But the twist is that he was influenced, and the real master behind this new version of the Masters of Evil is Ultron.
Yes,
Ultron. So you get a little Ultron appearance. This is Ultron 5, I think.
Yep.
And if I'm not mistaken, you got maybe you know, but I believe this is the first version of Ultron. So here we go with mm-hmm. significant first in Avengers history. This is the first Ultron that looks like Ultron. Like before, when he was introduced. Am I right about this?
Yeah. I don't think we've ever seen him before. I think that flashback was whole cloth made up. I don't think that was referring to a previous issue.
Oh, we never got the issue where he looks like a big vacuum cleaner or
no,
something?
I think that was just like backstory. I don't think that was a flashback to another issue. Because I was double checking that. I was like, wait a minute. It's one of those things where we've seen it so many times in later years that we just assume that that was, you know, a story. And I don't think it was. I think that when Hank explains later where he came from, I think that was it.
Okay. All right.
I think so.
All right. I'll follow you on that one.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Now he's still, he's not made of adamantium here.
No.
That comes later. Comes, I believe, around issue 64, 65, 66, somewhere in that area. I think 63, 64. So, but he does definitely look like Ultron. And coming up very soon in 57 and 58, we learn a lot more about him.
Yeah.
But I have to tell you, 56 is one of my favorites.
Okay. Why is that?
Well, for the same reason you were saying earlier, I have a tremendous amount of Marvel triple action nostalgia when it comes to issue 56. I have the Marvel triple action version of this issue. It was one of the very first comics I ever owned, and I still have it, and it is brutally beat up. Mm-hmm. But I've enjoyed comparing the two. There was definitely some editing to the cover. The color scheme on Bucky is different, and his position, how he's positioned on the page, has been reversed, I think. But other things were happening when the triple actions were being published. The comics were smaller. The pages were being trimmed. Mm-hmm. And the page count had been reduced. And so there are story pages from 56 that are missing in the reprints. And I think that happened with all the Marvel triple actions.
Holy cow.
So it was interesting to do a page-by-page read-through, comparing both as I was reading, and going, oh, well, they just skipped that page. And I'm looking at that page and like, well, yeah, I guess they kind of got away with that, you know. And sometimes it worked really smooth, and you don't notice anything. At other times, it might seem a little abrupt. You might wonder, like, you missed something. Well, the answer is you probably did miss something. They had to take a page out.
Crazy! I didn't realize that. Wow. So 56 is still dealing with Zemo, is that right? Because it's got Bucky and everything.
Well, you see Heinrich Zemo in flashback, but what you get here is the Avengers consist of Hawkeye, Goliath, and Black Panther join Captain America, who's not a member of the team, but he's asked for their help. He's called them in, and they're off to a place called Latveria. And Jan is staying back at the mansion. No, let me check real quick. Maybe she's going with him. Yeah, she's with him, and they're going into the castle. They're going into Dr. Doom's castle.
Oh, yeah.
And so now, we never see Dr. Doom, but what we get is a trip on the time platform.
Good old Dr. Doom's time machine. Everybody loves it.
And so Jan stays at the castle while the guys go back in time and observe what happened at the end of the war. And they're watching as the final showdown with the drone, and Steve and Bucky are trying to stop it. And they witness all over again Bucky's death.
Mm-hmm.
And they start to materialize. Oh, Jan has a sudden bout of dizziness or faints or something. She accidentally hits a control, and they start to materialize back in the old days and start to almost influence what happened at the end of the war. But you get a really nice retro story with Captain America and Bucky at the end of World War II, which, you know, as me as a kid, first coming into Marvel, this was my introduction to all this stuff. So it was that was really, really cool.
I got the impression that Roy wanted to flesh out the death of Bucky a little bit more from what Stan had probably done years earlier. Did you? Is that? Because it seemed
was fleshed out.
Yeah.
Now, I have not read the Tales of Suspense issues, if there are any that dig into this. We obviously got this version of Bucky's death very briefly in Avengers 4 when Captain America rejoins the team. I don't think was actually a story that was published during the Golden Age. This is all kind of retconned.
Right.
But I don't know if we if this is the first time we revisit this story of Bucky's death since Avengers 4. It's certainly the first time in Avengers, but maybe Captain America's own series dealt with it a little bit. I kind of doubt it, but somebody else would have to set me straight on that. So yeah, I think what you do get here is like really the first, or at least a closer look at exactly what happened on that last day.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, it just seems like Roy is once again going back and mining this treasure trove of original ideas and just fleshing them out, bringing them up to the present, making new stories out of them, using them to influence the present and the future. And it the only thing that really stood out about this story to me that I remember is me thinking, I think Roy changed a little bit here, or he's tweaked it a little bit, like why Bucky does what he does on the missile, why Steve does what he does, how it all plays out. It just struck me that Roy was going in and putting more motivational stuff and, you know, and conflict stuff there that, like in the original telling, they got on the missile, they fell off, exploded, you know, boom. There wasn't a lot of depth to it the original way. So that's fine. I mean, it made it.
I think you're right. And I think that's something he does very well. Again, just like tying Grim Reaper back to Avengers number 9.
Absolutely.
He's going back to something old and getting a new story out of it while at the same time developing the whole series and the backstory of all these characters. And in this issue, you know, Jan fainting at the controls seems like a pretty weird contrivance, but it actually becomes a plot point in the next couple of issues. So they do follow up on it. So at least there's that.
Yeah, at least there's that. So now we get to 57, 58. I guess we can look at those two, right? This is pretty important in Avengers history because this guy is going to go from being a new character that people don't even know who he is to ending up owning the corner box on the cover by himself for a long time.
Yeah, for at least a decade. You get the Vision here. And I have to double check. I'm going by memory. I think with Vision coming in here in issue 57, he is on the team, or he is in this book all the way until issue 211. Now, I'm not saying he appears in every issue because there may be a solo Hawkeye story or something, but he's on the team and an active member and a presence in the book all the way until he leaves in issue 211. I think I got that right.
That's amazing.
So, and he basically came to embody and epitomize the Avengers probably certainly through the 70s. He's like the only guy in the corner box. So he's definitely an iconic member of the team.
Yeah. And it's interesting because here he's brand new. And he scares poor Jan to death, which she calls him some unearthly Vision, which is where his name comes from. Now, I got to tell the story real quick with Roy. Roy went to Stan, right? Because Roy has said that he could do whatever he wanted, but if he's going to introduce a whole new character or a member or he's going to change things dramatically, he had to check with Stan. So he went to Stan and said, I want to bring back the Vision, that old character from back in the day.
Golden Age. Roy Thomas grew up on Golden Age. He loved Golden Age characters.
Yeah, and Stan said no. And Roy says, and Stan's like, well, what do you need him for? And Roy says, you know, tells him the story. And Stan says, just make him an android. And so Roy made him an android, basically a synthesoid, who is essentially the Vision brought back. In other words, instead of bringing back the exact character, Roy just invented a whole new character, made him look almost just like that character, and used the same name.
Yeah. and Stan probably didn't even notice.
And still, of course.
I was at the 1993 Dragon Con, and Stan and Roy were both guests. And I was in the room when they did their little panel, and Roy told that story with Stan sitting next to him.
Wow, I wasn't at that one, so I missed that.
Well, you know, Stan's reaction was he turned to Roy and goes, what, really? I said that? Like, okay, well, whatever. You know, he made it sound like there was no reason for him to say it, and he had forgotten that he said it. Just a little offhand comment like that gives us a character like the Vision.
Exactly.
We get who we get.
Yeah, exactly. And he is an amazing character, and he becomes one of the most popular characters, certainly for a long time. Now, I have to give my little spiel that I always do about the Vision, which is Roy said, and other writers after him for a long time went along with this, that the Vision is just like a human being. He just has synthetic parts rather than organic ones. But he has a brain. He has organs. He is he's like a human man, except with you know, plastic instead of flesh or whatever. And he has, you know, he's very similar to a human. Later on, of course, notorious writers and artists will turn him into a robot and have springs and gears and machine parts falling out of him and all that. But that's not the character.
You're right.
He has a lot more in common with Mr. Spock than with C-3PO. In fact, he has more in common with Mr. Spock even than with Data from Star Trek The Next Generation, because there was a certain amount of synthetic, a certain amount of artificialness to Data the Vision didn't have. He really was Roy Thomas's answer to having Mr. Spock on the team.
Yeah. And, you know, I wonder, I mean, this is 1968. It's right in the middle of Star Trek being on the air.
Oh, yeah.
So it's probably a pretty safe bet that it was a very conscious influence.
And it took him a little while to nail the Vision's personality down, because I thought this was funny, that early on when the Vision first is around them and then joins the team, he's bragging and being all the bombastic guy just like the rest of them. And he's constantly doing his, you know, I could do this with my diamond hard form, or I can turn to air and you can go right through me, ha ha. And it's only later that he really becomes more methodical and cold, and he doesn't have the yellow voice balloons yet, where it's more mechanical, you know. He's still at this point. In fact, he's in bold letters a lot of the time in these, where he's like yelling. So I think it's interesting how he evolved over time to become this very, you know, very analytical, cold, yet at the same time very affectionate toward, for example, Wanda. And his relationship with Pietro, which is really a high point later on, I think. Or a low point.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, as the character evolved, he turned into this guy who, like you said, was very cold, and kind of like just was missing that emotional connection to anything that was going on. But then later, you start to see hints that despite the coldness of the sound of the voice or the lack of emotion, there were still indications and hints that he was actually developing emotions and fondness. So, and that just added wrinkles to it. And I guess that's why he sustained as an interesting character. He definitely, you know, is a fan favorite for a reason, is an iconic member of the team for a reason. And it's just cool to see the introduction of him here. I'll pause and say that at some point, I think maybe 54, 55, but certainly by the time we get to the Vision story here in 57 and 58, George Klein has been inking Buscema here for the last several issues. And by the time we get to the Vision story here, the art is just absolutely on point. I think Buscema's Vision, you think of Buscema as specializing in drawing big, bulky guys like Conan.
Yeah.
But if you look at the Buscema Klein version of Vision, there's a lot of grace to it. I really like the look of the book as we get into these issues right here.
Yeah, and Perez would later pick up on that and make him a very – he's never like a Herculean-looking figure. He's more slender. He's very muscular, but he's always more slender. His face is always very narrow and slender. Again, he has a lot of that Leonard Nimoy kind of thing going on, as opposed to just being a – you know, a big bruiser or whatever. Let me pause for 1 second here, as we have to do to thank the folks that keep our shows on the air, and we will run through these really quickly. If you enjoy shows like this, the Avengers Assemble shows, and if you enjoy everything from our James Bond shows, our Game of Thrones shows, even, of course, the AU Wishbone and the Open Wheel Racing Show with Alan Porter, and all the stuff that the On Her Majesty Secret Podcast guys like Jared and his whole team are doing, including the new music shows that they're doing. All you got to do is for as little as a dollar a month, you can be part of the family and keep us going. You get all kind of benefits as well. In addition to having all these shows keep popping up in your podcast feed, you also, I've given away tons of free books. We give away early advance copies of things. You get discounts, all sorts of things if you go to our Patreon page. So for as little as $1 a month, you can help keep our shows on the air through patreon.com. So just go to www.plexico.net, plexico.net. And there's a big button there. There's all the players for all our various podcasts, and there's a big button to be a patron. So our current patrons, we have to thank, because we thank all of our patrons on every show. Brennan O'Dwyer, of course, and Samuel Salvatore, Christopher Burleson, and Carl Von Drunker, and Phil Amthor. We also thank Winston Boddy, Willie Carden, Susan Trawick, Ben Spooner, Stephen Thompson, Chris Usher, Justin Bean, Steve Trawick, and Richard Stevens. Johnny Caldwell, Reynolds Wolf, Joshua Corbett, Valiant Hermes, Jacob and Robin Fleming, Clay Henson, Ann Kangian, Catherine England, George Gaston, Will Summerford, John McCune, Tom Anderson, David Evers, Andrew Barber, Timothy, Steve Harlan, Dan Thompson, Wes Atkinson, Rich Reimer, Jared Albrick, William Glenn Matthews, Joel Beckham. Just a few more to go here. Theodore Gary, Shannon Butson, Taylor, David Hegler, Mickey B, Hugh Anderson, Shane Bailey, Mick Vigicana, Chris Thrash, Logan Chilton, Tony Perry, Alex Wynn, Josh Teal, David Simpson, Earl Ricks, Mike Finley, C.T. Wayne, Dave Powell. And then we have our last group, including Donnie, Reynolds, Wade, Carson, Ivor Evans, John Zavachin, Chris Camo, Darren Pyle, Chris, Wardam Wade, Jason Albrick, Randall Walker, Ben Amos, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, Patrick Williams, Rob Morgan, Stephen Schuster, James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Rains, Nicholas Gregg, Russell Milling, Matthew Wagstaff, Joey Miller, Mark Squire, Spanky, Brant Rumble, J.W. Rice, Michael Morton, Lawrence Kane, and our one-time and anonymous donors. Again, just go to www.plexico.net, plexico.net. There's players there for all of our various shows. You can just click on them to listen. And links to our videos, links to our books, links to everything we do, and you can join the Patreon there. Thanks very much. All right, Dave, so we've got like a handful of issues left to go that are really cool. Where should we go next?
Well, we can skip on ahead to 59 and 60, the two of them together make one story.
Yeah, that's another big seminal moment in Avengers history.
I know. I mean, bam. I mean, it's as soon as you get through with Vision and Ultron. By the way, 58 got into the whole Vision-Ultron connection and how all that worked. And then very next issue, bam, there's this guy, Yellowjacket, on the cover. And by the way, Hank Pym is laid out as Goliath, and Hank and Yellowjacket has got his foot on his chest. So that's kind of interesting.
Kind of tricking you there, trying to kind of not play it by the rules exactly. I guess there's that flashback thing, though, where Yellowjacket claims to have beaten him up and left him in the woods to die or something. I love how Yellowjacket's like, yeah, you know, you're a longtime founding member. Yeah, I beat him up and left him to die. And the Avengers are like, okay, well, I guess if Jan wants to marry you, we'll just overlook the whole murder thing. I just can't fathom that. But, okay, it works. It works.
Yeah, so Yellowjacket comes on as a new character. He's a mystery. Nobody knows who he is. And he comes on really strong. And he opens up by foiling a robbery, a burglary, and all that kind of stuff. But he basically, you know, he doesn't come across as very likable. He's very kind of rude and pushy and all that kind of stuff. By the way, just like Hawkeye introduced himself to the team in issue 16 by busting in and tying up Jarvis. Yellowjacket does the exact same thing. Poor Jarvis. Uh-huh. The only time I remember him is he's either serving tea or he's tied up by bad guys.
No kidding. And
here he is again, tied up by the Yellowjacket. So, and by the way, you get the gum chewing arrogant Yellowjacket that we see in Avengers Forever by Kurt Busiek and Carlos Pacheco. So what's really weird, what's really disturbing, well, actually, let me put it this way. What's really interesting about Hank Pym in this issue is, I came on as a reader with issue 211. That's Jim Shooter's return to the book. It is the beginning of the fall of Hank Pym. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't like that story because of what it did to the character, but that was my introduction to him.
Right.
And I'm hearing all this stuff about how he wore all these different costumes and different aliases and that he had this history of mental instability and everything. And I always kind of assumed that they were just kind of picking up from, previous appearances of the characters and writing something new. Like they just decided that Hank Pym was going to be this, crazy guy who was going to beat up on his wife. And, but what I see as I read these, there's definitely a basis for taking the story in that direction. I mean, he's a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
he's full on in a separate personality here.
Yep.
And there's a very disturbing page, disturbing certainly in today's modern era, and certainly disturbing in light of the of him abusing her in issue 213 or whatever it was. But there's an issue here where he forces himself on her by kissing her. Mm-hmm. And she's trying to fight him off, saying, let me go, let me go. And he just keeps kissing her anyway. And we don't like to see that, but it does, to me, strike true to the character based on my introduction to him with, you know, from the early 80s storyline. So, but what's really weird is this forced kiss that's without her consent. By the time it's over, she has a little thought balloon where she's saying, I basically don't want him to quit now. Mm-hmm. And by the next page, she's announcing to the team that they're going to get married. And which is like, wait, what? Now, I don't know if you remember, was it Joe Kelly that wrote the Earth's Mightiest Heroes limited series?
Sounds right.
I think it was Kelly, who basically did a couple different miniseries that filled in the gaps mm-hmm. between issues. Excuse me, it was Joe Casey.
Yeah.
And one thing he did there was introduced to me this idea that Jan knew it was Hank.
Oh yeah, I think she did.
She wasn't being crazy about it. She obviously, since their introduction to the series, had been wanting to marry him and get his attention, and so she knew what she was doing.
Yes. I always read it that way. Absolutely.
Now I don't know if I did. I must have read this story before I ever read Joe Casey's series. Mm-hmm. But coming back to this now, it really fell into place for me.
Yeah.
I think it's clear that after that kiss, she realized that's Hank. Now, that doesn't completely get her off the hook here, because clearly he's not in his right mind. And clearly she doesn't care.
Yeah.
And she's just going to marry him anyway in the middle of him being crazy. That's probably not the smart way to go. But to me, it makes the insane reversal at the end of issue 59, it makes it more palatable. It makes a lot more sense to me. It's like, okay, they really actually did, in the course of this story, play it like she knew what she was doing. So that made me feel a little better. Is it 58? Let me look real quick.
Well, I have two things about that.
Okay.
One is, I totally think she knew. And, well, for one thing, this is back in the era of Sean Connery, James Bond, where Bond just comes up to the woman he likes, and even if she resists him, he just kisses her and she melts and she is his. So this was an accepted thing in popular culture at that time, the idea that the woman says no, but the sheer animal magnetism of the sexy man will overcome her resistance and she will give in to him when he kisses her like that. Connery did it all the time, so you can see where a swaggering James Bond-like Hank, as opposed to the old boring stuffy scientist Hank, couldn't do that. Now, I would argue this is the Hank she's always wanted, right? You mm-hmm. always had the sense from day one in the Avengers that Jan wants the big He-Man, the alpha male, but she settled for Hank because he was the one she could get. She couldn't get Tony and didn't know he was Tony. He was Iron Man. She couldn't get Thor, although obviously she'd have thrown somebody off the side of the ship to get Thor from the day one. And so she basically settled on Hank as the one she could get. But you always got the sense that when he's looking at her, she's looking over his shoulder to see if, you know, somebody better is coming in. So when he becomes Yellowjacket here, he becomes the character that 1966 or whatever Jan wanted all along. So it's not surprising at all that when he turns into the man she wants him to be, he stops being, you know, Reed Richards and becomes Sean Connery or whatever. She's going to be like, heck yeah, let's get married now before you change back. You know, again, I'm saying within the context of a story set in the 1960s, I'm not saying now, no, I'm not. Y'all know that, right? But I'm just saying in the context of this story, when it was written and the world as it existed back then, I think it makes sense. And so I never had any – I'm not saying I didn't have any problem with it, obviously, but I never took issue with it making sense within the context of its time. How's that?
Yeah, that does make sense. And it's Yeah, and you explained it very well. I think I put a lot more of this. I don't blame Jan for as much as I think I used to here. Mm-hmm. For her to realize it's Hank, clearly there's a long established history of them being together.
Yeah.
And it's not crazy for her to just want to be with him. It really does, though, paint a disturbing picture of Hank.
Yes, it does. It does.
And I can't recall right now off the top of my head how often we come back to the issue of his mental stability until we start getting into the abuse storyline in the 80s.
That's right.
But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, he suddenly is this alpha male, swashbuckling, look at me. I don't want to be in my lab all day. I'm a superhero. Mm-hmm. And now she's got somebody she can show off.
Yeah.
Now, I look at me. I don't have the nerd anymore. I got this guy.
Exactly.
All that makes sense. That definitely makes sense.
And I just have to say, I'm so glad that the MCU version of Hank and Jan are not going down this road at all. They are older and they've had a happy life together and everything is fine and they have a daughter, and things certainly worked out for them better in the MCU than it did in the MU in the comics. Definitely.
Definitely. 60 is the wedding issue, which, by the way, another fantastic splash page from John Buscema.
Yes. Yes.
Hawkeye, by the way, this may surprise you, but things don't go smoothly on the wedding day. Some supervillains show up.
Of course. Of course. What do you think about it being the circus of crime of all people?
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. They come in as like the catering team in the back door.
It's like they're Parker robbing a party and don't realize it's a superhero party. It's just, you idiots. You absolute idiots.
And considering your feelings for Hawkeye, you probably enjoy his comeuppance. He is tied up along with Jarvis, and they're both hanging on fish hooks back in the kitchen.
Oh, that's great. Yes, absolutely.
Of course, you get the big fight and you get the big reveal that, Yellow Jacket is Hank all along. He was wearing another superhero costume under his Yellow Jacket costume.
I love that he gets married in the Yellow Jacket costume, too. And that was the other thing I wanted to mention, by the way, is that this is the first and pretty much last story where Hank as Yellow Jacket does anything effectively. It's like every Yellow Jacket story after this one, he's just flying around zapping the villain to no effect in the background like a mosquito.
That'll be something to watch out for.
I mean, I know you can probably say, well, like in that Marvel team up with Spider-Man and Jan, and they fight Equinox and all that, and the Super Skrull and all that. I mean, yeah, it was okay. But there's not a lot of great Yellow Jacket saves. In fact, I would argue that in the role of a shrinker, you really don't see Hank being that impressively powerful again until Avengers 161, when he's lost his mind again thanks to Ultron and takes the whole team out.
See, there you go. Mental stability again. So, I was not remembering that. But you're right. There's not a long list of key Yellow Jacket stories.
No.
Never mind. Train left the station. I was going to follow up on that. I forgot what I was going to say. I do want to say this. Nice little splash page of the wedding reception.
Yeah.
And you get a bunch of heroes making a little cameo appearance. The X-Men are there. Fantastic Four are there. What you get is you got Doctor Strange in his classic look, hanging out with a martini in his hand, talking to Vision and Iron Man. And in the background, you've got Hawkeye and Black Knight and Daredevil in a little huddle talking, making small talk.
Yep.
And the reason I point that out with Doctor Strange and Black Knight is because, at the very next issue, we get a huge story that features the two of them.
That's right. That's right.
But before all that action, they're hanging out at the wedding reception, drinking martinis and making small talk.
Of course. Well, now, let's get to our last two. So, 61 and then 62. 61, why does Doctor Strange not have a face? I don't understand what happened.
Did I miss a memo? I don't have an answer for you, but this is the second half of a crossover with Doctor Strange's book.
Okay.
So, what you get is, I think it's... hold on, let me call it up here real quick. I believe it's Doctor Strange 178 that's noted. And I don't know where they get that numbering from. I guess that's an old Strange Tales numbering or whatever. But the first half of this story is in a Doctor Strange book, which I have never I don't have that issue. It's a Dane Whitman story. I need to get it. I have tracked down a lot of old Defenders issues and everything else of his early appearances. This is one I don't have, but as far as Doctor Strange's appearance, because you're right, this is the weird look with the fully covered face,
mm-hmm.
More of a superhero look than a mystic wizard kind of look.
Yeah,
that's all in presumably explained in the events of his solo book. And so what we're thrown into the middle of the action. We went from the wedding reception with martinis and small talk to the splash page of Hawkeye and Black Knight going after Surtur, who's coming up over the horizon in an amazing splash page.
It is.
And then he actually opens with a double splash page because you got, I think, Ymir, the frost giant.
Yeah.
With Vision and Black Panther on the next page. So
this is, David, this is that period where this is just, this issue is a great, great, great example of what I'm talking about, where Roy comes up with great, grandiose ideas, and Buscema just executes them beautifully, and the double splash page is so dramatic, you think you're reading the Kree-Skrull War or the Korvac saga here, and then the actual story is just like, you know, 20 pages of, It's like, I know, I mean, and they fight, and the big, you know, the big finale is that they get them to run into each other and annihilate each other. And I read that, I was like, really? You set it up with this two-page splash page with this giant long title that's majestic, this amazing cover, and the whole thing comes down to tricking them into running into each other. I'm just like, wow.
You're right. I mean, I know, but you know, I'm biased. We have Black Knight in here, and
it's true. Yes,
and they've tweaked his appearance. This is his classic
he looks
look.
So much better here. Yes.
Yeah, the yellow cape and the yellow gloves are gone.
Gone.
This version of Black Knight right here, with maybe if you add a little red trim to the fold of his boots, this is my Black Knight.
Yeah, he looks great. He really looks great here.
And what's interesting is Doctor Strange performs a surgery in this issue.
He does.
And I didn't think that was cool. And what's weird is he performs the surgery in his superhero costume.
He does. I was like, you got to be kidding. I'm thinking this has got to violate like 15 different rules in the Doctor Strange comic. But hey, it's Avengers, so he can do whatever he wants here, you know.
Yeah. If I'm Dane Whitman, I'm like, excuse me, don't you have a problem with your hands? I don't know if I'd want that guy cutting off.
I was like, whoa.
But now listen, I know what you're saying. It was kind of a anticlimactic resolution to this. But there's pages in here of Hawkeye and Black Knight together on the back of the winged horse fighting Surtur. And the art is just absolutely amazing. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that gets me excited.
It looks great. This issue really does look great. Absolutely.
And we're going into our final issue here. And it's another example of what I'm about to say right now. And what we've seen here is a great, great example of how to do self-contained stories, self-contained issues, yet still have them build on one another and build a longer story. Mm-hmm. Every one of these flow and build one on another, but most of these are single issue contained stories or maybe two issues, like 59 and 60 belong to the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the second half of a crossover. I get it. But you'll get your Masters of Evil story, or you'll get your flashback to Dr. Doom's castle story. You get your Vision story and your Ultron story. You know, you get the Yellow Jacket story, and they're self-contained. They're not drawn out yet. Taken as a whole, they're definitely building to a larger narrative. And you get that with 62 as we go into the final issue.
M'Baka.
The events of. Go ahead.
I say you get M'Baka.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So with 62, the events of 61 lead straight into here. But now they've gotten through defeating the giants and they're hanging out with Doctor Strange. And now they're flying back and they decide to make their way to Wakanda before they go home. And so what we get is a really nice Black Panther story. It's a spotlight on him, his character and his setting, and his supporting cast all kind of come onto center stage. And we get us a nice Black Panther Black Panther man ape story right here in Avengers.
Yep.
Yeah. So do you have any thoughts? I got some thoughts on this, but I don't hear what you have to say first. Anything?
No, just the it's neat to see a Wakanda story, and it's also when they change the logo. We get this is where they become the Mighty Avengers, and we get our first new logo, I guess, ever, because we get rid of the little funky Avengers logo at the top that just said the Avengers with the A with a little arm on it and everything. And We're closing in on the day when we get the classic Avengers logo, but this is the one that kind of is wider on each end. It dips down in the middle, and it says The Mighty at the top. So it's still a good one. I think it's a stronger logo than the previous one.
Well, can I tell you, as I'm looking at thumbnails here, it's a short-lived one. They only have it for 8 issues, and by issue let me find it again. By issue 70, they're back to the original logo that you're talking about.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I don't know why they did that. And I think it was around 95 or so that they went to the classic logo that we all think of now.
Right, right.
So 62 is your Black Panther Man Ape story. So similar to my experience with the Grim Reaper story that we talked about, I wasn't sure. Was this our first look? Was this our introduction to Man Ape or not?
I'm not sure.
It absolutely is. This is his first appearance. He appeared right here. He's a Roy Thomas, John Buscema creation. So that's pretty cool. One of the two major villains in Black Panther's Rogues Gallery. Now, fast forward to our modern era. It's a little cringy. You're having an African guy dress up in a gorilla suit. Doesn't play well. It's not awesome. But what makes it palatable for me in this issue is they talk about how this is a throwback to old tribal ways, and it's not really the direction Wakanda is going. Like, already, even in this first appearance, it's kind of being portrayed as like, look, that's a throwback that's not progressive, and that's not where we want to go. So, to me, and plus, you know, you've got the animal tribe motifs. You know, you got the panther tribe, you got the ape tribe. So, you know, to me, it makes sense. They're both jungle animals. So, to me, it works, especially for the Silver Age. So.
Yeah, I thought it was a very strong story, and it had a couple of great moments where the Panther tries to be, because, you know, that was established over many, many years in many different comics, that the Black Panther is above all honorable, right? He's a man of honor and decency, and he believes everybody else should behave that way. So, of course, we get the great, you know, type of deal where his opponent keeps trying to beg for mercy when he's down and then stab him in the back when he's back up again, because the Black Panther is always going to be merciful and always going to have, pity for and try to, you know, redemption. And so, of course, a villain like that will always defeat himself, right? Because in fact, it would be interesting to do another story later where you see what happens when the Panther is put in a position where he has to make the decision to really put the villain down, because, you know, it's almost too easy to have this kind of a villain who's selfish and you know, basically will say anything to get out of being defeated, but then he'll turn around and stab you in the back. It's almost too easy for the writer to have him defeat himself so that the hero's hands are clean. And I'd like to see what T'Challa would have to do sometime when his hands aren't clean, when he has to do something, even though he doesn't want to. But no, I think this is I think this is one of the stronger stories in this entire run, even though it really is focused almost entirely on Wakanda and the Panther's background, as opposed to all the other, you know, Avengers related stuff.
Yeah, and keep in mind, you know, we associate, not counting the movies, strictly the comic books, we associate Black Panther strongly with the Avengers. But the reality is, he's never spent a long time as a member of the team. He's mostly just shown up for a guest spot here or there. This is it. For largely, as far as being a member of the team, this is his key run as a member of the team, is right here during these Roy Thomas issues that we've looked at.
Yeah, it really is. And and that's one of the neat things about the Avengers too, is that sometimes you get them together as a team, as a collective, and you're really in Avengers Mansion, and it's all about them being together. But other times you can have stories like this where you go off and see them in their own element with guests, you know, like the Vision is there and Hawkeye is there and everything, and the Black Knight and Doctor Strange, and you get to see these far flung elements of the Marvel Universe that we don't always see. So that was pretty cool too.
Yeah. Awesome.
So that brings us to our last one for this run. What are your final thoughts, David, in terms of this run and that we haven't talked about already that makes this so special and worthwhile.
Well, we've already touched on it, but I don't think it can be emphasized enough. It's all the world building as far as making the Avengers what they are. All the DNA for the series is right here in the Roy Thomas run, and a lot happens in just this narrow window that we looked at today. Mm-hmm. If I can, as we were talking, I was making notes. This is how many firsts that we have just in 47 through 62.
Okay.
We get the first appearance of Dane Whitman. We get the first appearance of the Dane Whitman Black Knight. We get the first appearance of the Grim Reaper, the Crimson Cowl, Vision, Yellow Jacket, the first Avengers appearance of Panther, Black Panther. We get the first Man-Ape. All in these issues we talked about. If you just go a little bit further, in 63, we get the first appearance of Clint as Goliath. He takes over the Goliath persona. In the very next issue after that, 64, we get the first appearance of Barney Barton, Clint's brother, and it's a story that involves the swordsman, and it reaches back to a little bit of Clint's backstory. Right after that, you get the first appearance in the Marvel Universe of Animantium, which leads to the return of Ultron, and he is at last in his Animantium body. And this is and then in 69 or 70, you get the introduction of Arkin and his world.
Mm-hmm.
All that happens 47 through 70, and there's just so much packed in. And by the way, for any Black Knight fans out there, 71's a really good issue to read.
Wow, it is amazing. Yeah, great stuff. So, all right, well, there's Avengers 47 through 62.
That's right.
And when we reconvene at some point in the future, where do you want to go next, just so people will know what to look for?
Well, I've got a lot of ideas. I know that we've often gravitated to our favorite runs of the book, which for us, you and me both, late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. And we can definitely dig into that more. I wouldn't mind continuing on with the Roy Thomas stuff here through the Kree-Skrull War.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw this at you on the air. We have not talked about this. I would suggest that maybe we kind of go outside our comfort zone a little bit and dig into Operation Galactic Storm.
Interesting.
Roy Thomas was one of the contributing writers. It's very much set up as a sequel to the Kree-Skrull War. There's a lot of parallels. And Star Force, the Kree Star Force, plays a key role in the story, which could... has a little bit of a tie-in to the Captain Marvel movie, so that might be kind of cool to look at.
Absolutely, yeah. So we need to pick back up and go through the Kree-Skrull War, and then we can come back and do Galactic Storm. That would be awesome. All right.
Yep, sounds good, man. Let's do that.
We've got our agenda in place. All right. Well, I think the Avengers Assemble podcast is going to wrap up again, but the Avengers will return soon with more. In fact, I think that probably our next show, unless something comes along before that, we will be doing probably a preview of Avengers Endgame coming up soon, and then I'm sure we'll have all kinds of maybe a roundtable review of it. So stay tuned for all of that. Of course, other stuff may come along even before that. So, all right, David, we're going to get out of here, but we appreciate you coming on.
Sounds good, man. Appreciate having me on.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.